And welcome to Dark Guidance. I'm Chris.
I'm Brian.
I'm D-Tom.
I'm Colin.
I'm Other Tom.
All right, we did it, everyone. And welcome, everyone, to this cast. We have a round of five here, which is quite a lot of people. We've managed to get ourselves nice and packed over here. And today we're going to bring you we're going to cover a couple of topics. For one, we're going to probably inevitably talk about Malvern and Mayhem, because those guys are cool. And places they're not quite cool at, and places they really are cool at, like, say, Minions and Mercenaries, oddly enough. But today we figured we'd talk mostly about a subject that crops up from time to time, and I figured we could do some justice to it, and that is specifically planning of turns, executing them, and then our favorite thing, and the reason we've got Colin on here for this cast, shoveling, i.e. digging your way out of a bad situation that was basically your fault.
I reject that remark.
We should talk about the new pig caster also. He seems pretty okay.
Oh yeah, he's great.
I think he is okay.
Yeah.
My only complaint with him is that he and Midas have a huge amount of overlap in the list that I want to play them.
Don't worry, that's because he's actually a troll caster, Colin.
No, I think it's because Minions just has so many fucking solos that are good right now that he is a solo caster and so is Midas.
I think he's a better solo caster than Midas now that he's got his white boar pistol, but...
I don't know. Weapon Master Void Archons are a hell of a drug.
Yeah, but... Man, that feat, and them, like...
I agree. Void Archons under that feat are clearly better. The problem is that you can only have one of your Archons with Stormrager, and you can only have one turn with the feat. Whereas in Midas, you get three people that are Weapon Masters every turn if you want it.
Yes. But man, that feat. Those primal archons are like absolutely disgusting. Holy shit.
Also, bonus points, Wastelander, that guy is really a cool guy.
Yes.
So we were talking about the weird shit you could do with him.
Yeah.
Did you talk about putting him under Azazello's feet with two Junian archons and also Linus and Adria so that he gets like the ability to punch people back, pick where it goes, and you can't kill him?
No, we were instead talking about hiding him behind Malvern and Mayhem, putting up Roadblock.
Behind Mayhem.
Shield Guard with his weird Shield Guard. You still have to roll an attack roll against Wastelander, and now he's at plus
Death 4 defense. 21.
Death 21. Plus 2 for your Blade Shield, and then plus 4 for hiding behind Malvern and Mayhem, giving him cover.
And then you still have 2 Junian Archons to keep him alive.
In the extremely unlikely chance they hit 21. Oh, man. Junian Archons, incidentally, also a hell of a thing. But we're not necessarily talking about all of those pieces today, although that's not... They will probably come up in conversation one way or another. Instead, we're sort of going to be talking about, effectively, the anatomy of, I'd say, big turns. Which in War Machine, to me, usually means, I'd say, grossly speaking, two main kind of turns, and sometimes they'll overlap. One is usually what is probably your feat turn. It's like your turn 2 to 3, your main turn where you're going in, you're either alphaing or you're countering. It's time to pop the feat. It's time to just, like, spend as much resources as you can get.
Smoke him if you got him.
This is the time where Rask has just finished popping his feat. He goes like, all right, you got boundless charge, you got boundless charge. Spellslave gives that guy boundless charge. Let's do this. Right? And then your opponent counters with whatever's left of it, and it's just going, all right, this guy's going in, my cast is going in, let's do this. How exactly to execute that in more of a general sense, but also, like, what priorities you have to pay attention to. And then the second is, of course, after you completely fuck it up because you've overcommitted with Rask, and you've now lost 4/5 of your list somehow, how to then randomly kill them. Or win the game, which is not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, and I think the point there would be around working out what order you're going to play the pieces and make the moves. One of the things that I notice, and I do it as well, particularly if I'm out of practice, is when you have that big turn coming, your mind is kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to do so much damage to that thing. I'm just going to do that right now. And then you're kind of forcing yourself to stop and think on that turn. Can be difficult if your opponent has given you something that you think of as like, this is it. As long as I get that, this game's over, and it's like it's straightforward. All I have to do is deliver this piece and then I'm good.
You get and you kind of jump vision.
To it. Yeah, you do. You jump to it and you do that thing possibly before you actually want to do that thing. Because either, well, sometimes, worst case, you fuck it up and you don't primal it first, for example, or you do something stupid. That can happen. But second case, you do it, and then you realize that what you actually needed to do was one other thing first, just to find out whether that other thing worked.
Yes.
Because it makes a huge difference to how the rest of that turn plays. So, and identifying those things that you want to try, because if they work, they make a huge difference to how the turn plays out. And if they're not going to work, you want to know before you do the rest of your turn.
To borrow a term from Hearthstone, actually, it's basically you want to see if you just randomly high roll. Like, you know, you do something like an example from, say, Mark II. You have your Iris walk up. She, the only thing she can really shoot is your warcaster, your opponent's warcaster. So you just walk up, you take the shot, and you just see what happens, right? It's the only functional target. You lose nothing for trying so, realistically speaking, in a lot of these situations. But on the other hand, if you, you know, roll the 9 or whatever it is to hit your opponent's warcaster, the whole turn suddenly massively shifts gears. There'd be other things too, like, say, I mean, we'll take Wastelander, like we just, like, talked about, right? Let's just say his only charge target is a Colossal. You have him go first, and you just see how well he rolls. And yep. Wastelander has Decapitation. How well he rolls is sometimes a huge deal. Like, it's not like you, when you're doing, going through these turns, you sort of want to, the general philosophy, at least I've got, is you typically, you want to activate most of your enablers first, so to simplify this, like, a lot of the big turns usually involve removing one key piece. Either it's multiple heavies, or it's a Colossal, or it's a bunch of units, like a heavy, like a medium-based shield wall unit, or even just that guy plus a few key solos. You know, a couple of Primal Archons. Whatever it shakes out to be, you typically order, your typical order is you want your enablers to go first, then you want all of the guys who pretty much only have one thing they're going to be able to hit anyway, just go and attack the thing they're going to hit and just see how it shakes out. And then you start rolling back to your more flexible pieces, your last activation ideally being the guy who has most of the options and can therefore troubleshoot. So like Alexia, Void Archons, that sort of thing. Even your caster sometimes, if your caster happens to have a spell slinging capability. And yeah, you sort of want to work your turn backwards.
I guess, so just to sort of start, like, make sure that we sort of follow, like, a bit of a line of logic for people listening and stuff like that. So let's start by, like, just identifying what does a big turn mean? And maybe think about, like, when you're playing different types of lists, what are big turns? So if I was playing, like, a very melee focused or a very scenario-driven list versus, like, a gun line versus, like, a very control-based list, how would we sort of change the definition of big turns and what does that mean and the implications for those lists?
Well, it depends on the type of big turn you want to do. For me, a big turn usually comes after the opponent's alpha turn. I like to play lists where I set up my list to take an alpha strike and then immediately follow up with my big turn. So the turn leading up to my big turn will usually be about layering my troops, setting up where they need to be, and then being able to hit back as hard as possible after you've baited in their most valuable pieces. So you can play lists like Karchev lists, or you can play Zol 2 like that. So it's all about setting up prior turns to fully take advantage of your big turn, which usually means setting up your model in the exact right place so that you can then follow up with your heavy hitters to take out whatever they have remaining. In case of Zol 2, you can also set up your secondary plan or your backup, which is essentially turn shovel, which is, I guess, what we're going to come to eventually. And that's about setting up so that if the attrition swings way too hard and you've lost way too many models, then you have your way to hopefully take out the enemy caster or swing back a scenario or attrition play with a more scalpel type of play rather than a hammer.
Yeah,
and so it's all about setting up your models in the right places. You can always take advantage of that and then swing your plan as the game progresses.
Yeah, Zol 2 actually is a pretty good illustrator of this kind of style. So you say that you want to bait your opponent out. Well, in Zol, you typically have 1 to 2 giant stone boys with these big swords. And a kind of common thing I've seen is like sometimes you try and bait your opponent with a guardian ancestral, sorry, supreme guardian without feeding on it, specifically so that you can like next turn when they do commit to you, they might come up short because of the way you've set it up anyway, or you're just comfortable wearing that loss and then you counter into them with the feat. But a lot of it comes down to individual caster interactions as well. Like, there's some guys you kind of just don't want to eat the alpha from. Like, eating the alpha from, say, Peascot, generally speaking, never works out that well. But getting alpha...
depends on the list, right, Chris? Like, you know what you're going into.
Yeah.
If you're playing into Scar and you're taking the alpha, then you're probably setting up for plan two rather than plan one, which is... let's kill Scar or yes, everything valuable to her following up.
Indeed, indeed. I find in general, a lot of it will come down to caster dynamics, but it's not the worst. Like, it is always worth considering when you start the game, pretty much like how you imagine your bigger turn going. Like, do it just basically when you're sitting down. It's like your opponent's turn, just thinking about a couple steps ahead, maybe during list selection, what turn 2 to 3 is going to probably look like. Because a lot of it come down to, like, the simple fact is who goes first and how fast are the respective lists. So for me personally, I think casters, basically, a lot of lists in general, you kind of want to be able to be flexible, be able to do these kind of plays. But typically speaking, it's when you're going for an offensive plan or a defensive plan, you need to know like what you actually find valuable in the list and what your opponent actually does instead, because they're not always the same thing. We did say earlier, and with Colin was talking about it, there is a lot of times when you just focus in on the big thing. You want to kill the big thing, and then you realize later that, say in the Zal case, the big thing, it's like a mammoth, or it's a supreme guardian or some shit like that. You're like, yeah, I want to kill that big thing. It's going to be great. And then you dedicate your entire turn to kill the big thing, and then you come around and you realize, actually, I've made two fuck-ups here. One, I didn't activate, say, Wastelander and see if he randomly, like, A, baits out a defensive strike, and B, you know, just does a shit ton of damage, or some model in a similar capacity. But then B, you realize, actually, I didn't need to just kill the big thing. The more important model was probably the one right behind it. And I failed to kill the Arknode. Zal then is, like, loaded up with a shit ton of fury, and my caster's head explodes.
I think, really, yeah, that's a good point, Chris. I think one of the things that I found really powerful in terms of learning about this concept and applying it to the game was actually through lists where short sort of shovels were inherently built into the list, actually kind of quite prominent in their game plan. So, like, one of the big sort of points of growth in learning for me with War Machine, and particularly around how to recover an ordinary game state, was when I picked up Rhett and started playing Rahn. And the fundamental reason is that, like, Rahn is a very strong assassination caster, and a lot of the time your opponent, if they're sort of somewhat wizened to what Rahn will do, is going to actively play against that strategy. So they're going to play against your sort of ability, or they're going to try and scalpel out the pieces that enable you to do this sort of big play that wins you the game. And with a cast that's fairly heavily focused on assassination, that gets felt quite heavily. When they succeeded that sort of goal. And what became really interesting is that you learn to set up the game so that you're never giving things away that you're not willing to, or at least you're conserving pieces that enable sort of that long-term threat in the game, whether or not it's the ability to kill a colossal, or you just like identify that, you know what, unless everything in my list is absolutely able to be delivered all the time, I actually can't kill that colossal in this matchup. But also, that colossal can only kill so many things because of placing, because of threat ranges and all that sort of stuff all the time. So if I learn to play this list around that element, and I can sort of learn how to like pull at strings and set up in a way that I'm not losing great amounts of my long-term game plan regularly, then often that the ability to find that like quote-unquote shovel, or just that way out in the game in terms of it being a scenario victory or an assassination, That sort of becomes a bit more strongly placed in the game plan.
Yes, because...
And I think that's... Sorry, go.
I was going to say, pretty much because from the start, it's not like something you're considering after you've literally been smacked in the face a few times, like, all right, whatever I got left, it's more calculated. You're like, well, I know I've got a chimera left. Why? Because I've spent the most of the game making sure that it's like just that little bit out of the forest so it can apparate and then run, and then I can get the thing there. Okay, it means you've got more tools in the pocket, so to speak.
Yes, and you learn to play, like, you learn to play the, like, in the Ryan example, you learn to play games because you're becoming more matchup aware and things like that. Like, you know what? Like, Ryan is really powerful, but I don't need to throw my Arcanoid away and feed on turn two to wipe out, like, this unit, because turns out that you can only do so much to my army. So I'm just going to hold it back, let them sort of overextend themselves, chip away at them, and eventually the power of that piece is actually going to be able to be leveraged much harder, like, later turns than it was going to be able to be leveraged early turns. And I think that that's a really sort of powerful way to start looking for the shovel pieces or the shovel plays or the at least the direct routes to victory in a game plan.
Honestly, in most cases, the longer you can hold on to a feat in most will increases its viability over the course of a game, unless it's an alpha feat. But generally, most feats gain value the longer you hold on to them because they tend to turn up your models from like a 9 to a 10.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So even defensive feats are obviously not
the opposite
necessarily. Yeah.
It depends on the type of defensive feat. Like I find if you have a Zol 2 feet where it's just numbers, if you can hold that past the turn, people expect you to pop it. Like having an Ancestral Guardian in the middle of the table, having a Supreme Guardian in the middle of the table, engaging most of the army, having had already done work and then being feated on is incredibly infuriating for your opponent. Because by then they've often popped feats, or they weren't planning to have to deal with it on turn three or like on four or five.
Yeah, so, that's actually.
So the reason... Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say that kind of is because a lot of the times, like let's just say you're up against Scar or something, they've set up their game plan, their clock, like they're going to feat to counter your feat, and then you're now eating a bag of dicks. But when you say commit your guardian, you hold your feat for that one extra turn, they're like, well, do I pop my feat now? Is that the correct course of action? Because then I now have to deal with this fucking piece of shit.
The only one I will put out there, which is one that it took me a long time to learn for Rask, is if you have a purely defensive feat, which his feat really is, and you don't pop it, you can often put yourself in a much worse position than you expected to put yourself in. It's extremely difficult to judge how bad the position is going to be. And if you don't have the time or the willpower or the mental power to make that judgment and be absolutely certain, it is often better in the case of defensive feats to just go, all right, I am going to feat and I'm going to position as if I'm going to feat and I'm going to do it and not let yourself have that moment of, oh, but if I hold it, all they can get to is this one piece because that leaves them open to doing something that you weren't expecting if you've miscalculated slightly and losing all of your initiative. And if your list is very dependent on that because you've got a defensive feat, it can really hurt.
The term in the board game or the card game sense is tempo. And yes, sometimes giving that away would be a fucking terrible mistake. I do find that that's more of a thing that you learn depending on how many times you play that matchup, like how much you can get away with. So that's probably even a good sign. That's probably a sign you're in trouble when you play against someone and they're not playing the game plan, but they seem to know exactly what they're doing. It's almost like they've probably practiced that kind of shit before.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a bit disturbing.
The way I would describe the Rask feat as a defensive feat would be like zoning. It's all about controlling when and where the opponents engage you, which is why the farther the game goes on, the harder it is to actually keep a zoning feat relevant in the game.
Yeah.
Whereas not all defensive feats are about zoning in that case.
No, I agree.
But that's why Rask's early feat is incredibly powerful, because it determines the tempo rather than changes the tempo.
Like an alternative example of a very similar of a feat that is extremely powerful for saving at the late game is like, say, Fiona's feat. if you feed on Fiona's feet after they've blown a good chunk of their resources, it's just completely backbreaking. Because you then get tempo, you basically get to, like, double alpha them in the mid-game, which is just horrifying, and they can't do shit.
Well, you've used up a lot of your resources that would help you answer those problems.
Yeah.
Which is the same when you're talking about Zol 2 or when it changes the stats of models versus when it changes the ability to reach models.
Yeah. So we've actually thrown a lot of words around, like, you know, like shovel and tempoing and all that sort of thing. But a lot of these come down to these, like, pieces, which are basically, they exist in every army. They're pretty much these kind of things that are either assassination enablers or just, frankly, gameplay enablers. So I thought we should go into them, like, because a lot of them, they share common similarities, I find. First, important is casters. The kind of casters that enable you to have these power turns. They inevitably sort of end up being the best casters in their factions on a general sense, because they, like, for whatever reason or other, they allow you to, like, the sign of an incredibly powerful caster, I find, is that you can play into a bad matchup and still have a chip and a chair of winning. And if you play into a good matchup, then it isn't necessarily that your numbers will beat theirs, but it's also that your numbers and your ability to control the game means that they're playing your game at a disadvantage. They're literally trying to run uphill through the snow both ways, and they're getting decked on all sides. So pieces, for instance, are just extremely strong, and, like, I think we could start from the minions aspect here, because to me there's just really one piece that encapsulates everything I've got to be saying in a nutshell, and that's Roshan Brine. What a fucking guy. Pair of guys. Pair of pigs. What a pigs.
Yes, and losing them early is painful. Getting value out of them is one of the critical parts of the way, specifically the list I'm used to playing plays. But in general, they are a good exemplar, as you say, of a type of piece that gets almost all of its value out of an alpha of some sort, but knowing when you're getting value and when that value is not as good as it looks becomes super critical. And it's a hard one, because for a lot of pieces, and Roshan Brine are an example, but a lot of lists have a cannonball piece that they can just fire out into a target of opportunity and get value, and that's the hope. And when you have those pieces, if you use them too early, or if you effectively waste them, either on something that isn't worth killing, or on something that they fail to kill, which can happen quite often as well, then that's super sad for your list. And I guess from Brian's point of view, flipping it the other way, being able to bait your opponent into doing that is super important in those matchups, because if you can manage to get them to throw that piece on something that they just fall short on killing because you've got some other trick up your sleeve for keeping them alive, then that can win you the game on its own.
Fuck, even if they let you do it, like, can you, like, if I was playing Zol 2 and my opponent throws Roshan Brine to kill a Supreme Guardian, fuck, I'm just going to be like, shake the game, good game, you've lost, idiot, thank you very much. Like, that'd be
it depends on when they can reach it, because sometimes you might take that gamble where you haven't feeded yet, and then a Roshan Brine can kill it. So yeah, then it depends on if you can set up your turn around it possibly dying, or making it very hard for him to kill regardless of feed or not. So it becomes a game of, like, who's prepped more for this turn, and that's, I guess, where shovels come out, right?
Yeah, but yes. It's also a little bit of, like, actual, like, physical trickery as well. Like, you know, mental trickery almost. But, like, I'll put it this way. When, in the event of, say, Roshan Brine dying in at least that particular matchup, say it's Rask versus Zol 2, man, if you actually had Rosh commit to kill an Ancestral Guardian, and then you can kill, like, sorry, Brine commit to kill an Ancestral Guardian, can kill
Supreme
Brine.
Guardian.
Supreme. Jesus Christ, I'm getting all the names wrong. But yes. If Brine kills a Supreme Guardian, and then you're able to kill Brine back, well, what's actually happened is you've basically taken one piece off the board that can then really fuck up your plans later down the line. Like, the damage again, this is why I thought Brian is a good example. Other examples of similar models, for instance, would be easily stuff like Void Guardian. Void Archons, for instance. These kind of pieces where they have just like a lot of different things they can do. Once you coalesce it so they're forced to do one particular thing, it really like it gives you a big edge when you damp down on the angles they've got. So Brian committing to kill your Supreme Guardian now means that Brian is not waiting in the wings for Zal to overcommit so that Brian can then just go and beat that guy in the face.
And it means that Zal can come forward, right? Or whoever your other equivalent is. Once your opponent has lost their real reach out and touch you pieces, you get a much better control of the game and you're able to leverage the power of your pieces much more effectively because you know that you're not putting them at risk. And that's definitely something that you feel when you're playing a list that depends on those pieces. You definitely feel it when you lose them. And if you lose them for a trade that turns out to not be a good trade, it often does cost you the game.
Indeed. Like in that particular example, I'm pretty sure Brian is cheaper than a Supreme Guardian. So on paper, you're trading up. But in actual fact, you're kind of just through the game, perhaps.
In actual fact, I've had Brian go through Zal with 3 transfers and a Mammoth.
Nice.
So yes. Putting him into a Supreme Guardian is not that great a trade.
Other example, as I said, the Void Archon's another example there, and probably one where when you're playing a matchup, it's probably important to give a thought at least to what your big action pieces, like say a Void Guardian, are capable. Sorry, Void Archon are capable of doing, because it will give you an idea of how much you want to throw them or how much worth it is to actually hold on to them. Because there's not always going to be the game where you want to hold on to Brian like he's basically the golden goose. Sometimes it's actually worth it to have him go out there and get some shit stuck in, because it'll make the rest of your game much easier.
Oh, definitely. If he can get to a really critical piece, particularly if he can kill a support piece that people weren't expecting to have die, that can be backbreaking as well.
Yeah. It's going to be one of it's this weird case where it might be better for Brian to kill the Arknode solo than to kill the Supreme Guardian.
As long as he gets something else with it.
Yes. As long as he does. But yes.
Well, there's usually stuff nearby.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is.
You can normally
make that. The guy's like a guided missile, right? That's his entire role in the game.
Overtake gets you into a lot of weird places.
Yep.
You get in some fine adventures with it. But yeah, Void Archons. So this is the part too, also, where when you're using when you identify these kind of pieces in your list, and first things first, you probably a lot of list construction aims to put as like at least for most good tournament lists, you'll notice aims to put these kind of flexible pieces in with a right mixture of that with like good old work beat you in the face pieces. And there are a bunch like. Even if we go dial away from the action-packed minions and we go to something a little more like tame, sedentary and boring, like Menoth, for instance, no one could really accuse Menoth of going like full crazy on like having awesome pieces. And yet, the fact that they have things like, say, Fire of Salvation is like one of the weirdly tricky pieces where he's obviously a crusader, and frankly, he's the best. I'm pretty sure he's the best character heavy in the game, although Malvin and Mayhem may now give him a run for his money. But the fact that he's got an out-of-activation movement, the fact he has Pathfinder without needing an objective to give it to him, or a fucking church to tell him he's ghostly now, the fact he's got Righteous Vengeance, the fact he's got magic weapons and Dispel, and with Krios 3 or any of the Krioses, actually, he's just got like the ability to kill literally anything he touches. Even though he's basically a premium character heavy, he's also like one of these weird tech pieces, and his presence on the field, when you throw this piece out and how, will actually be a pretty big deal. So like, big turns in general, like when you're on the approach, they're not always about like numbers. It's not always about points killed, it's not always about how many models killed, or how flashy a play you do. Like your Doom Reaper goes in and chops up 10 immortals and you just like yell and you're like yay and it's all great, and then you forget to kill the one that actually is contesting the zone and you're like oh shit, and you realize then that actually the immortals that all dying just fueled up the Supreme Guardians, and now you're just fucked.
Yep.
I guess that like comes into the like sort of the conversation of sort of how important understanding the process behind like execution is, and sort of the what you need to what sort of the mindset and the steps you need to go through to make sure that you are ensuring that those are like those are being sort of met, like that those criteria for a successful turn are being met, and how to identify that throughout the turn, right? Like it's really like yes, it's really important to like score points and kill models. But if you don't have a clear idea of what that turn will look like at the end of it, when like sort of when you start your activations, it can also it probably also makes like adjusting game plans really difficult, or at least making effective adjustments to game plans really difficult, because you kind of like at that point you're sort of just chasing whichever car comes your way.
yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And that can be like a fairly like at least I feel like that's where I see a lot of people get really unhinged and tilt quite heavily when they play, is because basically like they sort of just had this idea in their head that like this thing that I have is awesome and it's going to do awesome things, and then I pointed it at the thing and it didn't do everything that I hoped it would, and actually in the process I lost the game. And like because I wasn't cognizant of like I don't know like a void archon can like go and kill more guys, or it could blink back and contest, or it could or I could put a heavy into like this awesome solo, which is camping a flag. But by doing that, it means that the heavy dies, and I've got no way to play the rest of this game. Yeah. Like having a really like clear understanding of where your game plan wants to be, or at least what like at the end of the turn looks like, or what the end of your opponent's next turn should look like, is really fundamental to making sure that you aren't putting yourself in need to assassinate scenarios all the time.
You're right, that also is, if you don't have a clear idea of what you think the end of the turn should look like, you kind of also don't know when it's gone off the rails. So you don't even know that you need to use your shovel, right? Because you're still rolling dice and you're still doing stuff, and it's not until the end of your turn that you look back and go, I thought I had a plan for killing that thing, and then you're like, oh, I remember that didn't work, but I didn't swap plans at that point in time. I just kept on keeping on, and now Eris is still standing there, and it turns out I'm going to get shot in the face.
Yep. And that's where like not only target prioritization but activation priority becomes really important, because like what you guys were talking about before, like an Iris example, but if you can apply it to anything taken on, so say I needed to clear like X heavy and out of the zone, well I probably want to do my least valuable activation first, because if I get lucky and like I do this to Frawley all the time, which is like I play Wallbirds and I just go like, well, Wallbirds have lots of shots and they can roll lots of dice, so I'm just going to roll this at this thing, and if it rolls like above average, you're really screwed. And if it doesn't, I'm not really losing anything out of it, because all I'm giving you is the opportunity to come kill a Wallbird, which isn't the most important piece in my army. So you can leverage sort of those, like, yes, it is luck, but it's also sort of it's either going to be a nothing trade, like I'm not really losing anything for doing it, or I'm actually exposing a part of my army that you are probably going to overcommit to killing, and that feeds right into what I want to do.
Yeah, it's like you get to high roll with the Wald Weird. Like, there's a chance the Wald Weird just, like, rolls above average on its shots, right? And just does... I mean, the classic example that always tilts me is when it, like, knocks out Cortex or movement on a Warjack. 100%. And you're just like, well, that means that I don't need to kill that heavy anymore, and you're just like... You're right. You haven't lost anything realistically. That Wald Weird probably only had one-ish target.
Yep.
You took the shot, and your opponent gets tilted because you, as far as they're concerned, you just got lucky because you rolled a 15 and a 16 for your damage, and you're like, cool, I'm a fucking genius player at War Machine. But when you actually look at it, you just set up the opportunity. You just took the gamble, see what happened, and then it wasn't like you were depending on rolling a 15 and 16 to kill some shit, unless your plan was really off the rails.
Yep.
Which has happened.
Yep. But also, like, just by rolling those dice, I'm not saying, like, be lucky is part of the game plan, but you're creating sort of, like, low-consequence movement and low-consequence...
And you're maximizing the actual effect of the luck when it happens, which is really critical. Because in the example for that Eris shot, if you have a throwaway shot that you know is a throwaway shot and you take it at the end of the turn, then
no
you
impact.
Just missed your chance, right?
Yep.
Whereas if you take that shot first, then you can rewrite your entire turn completely just around the fact that you've accidentally knocked down their caster with a shot that had no reason at all to knock down their caster.
Yes. Yeah. I guess... You go, Chris, sorry.
I got the perfect example of that was WTC 2018. I had a 50-50 to shoot Krios 1 in the face with a 5 for affected field gun. The only loss of activations I'd have would be Kovnik Joe for the attack boost, and the field gun, which literally only had one target, which was his Warcaster. So I flipped the coin, it landed as heads, and I won the game.
Yep.
And yeah, like, that was, if that hadn't worked, like, it wouldn't have cost me anything, because the entire turn was basically set up around, actual turn was going to be preventing Krios from ever being able to feat on my caster, because if he can walk up and feat on my caster, that means he can cast Purification first, strip no knockdown, and my entire army just evaporates, right?
Yep.
But yeah,
man,
like,
we have very different memory from that tournament. Like, speaking of shoveling, that tournament was, I was stuck, I was just started in the hole, I had to dig my way out.
That was the Thagrush one, right?
That was the Thagrush list, yes. Nice. Well, some of us decided to show up with, like, you know, more than one Hellmouth in, more than one Hellmouth in our list.
Yeah, but so speaking of shoveling, that tournament was, like, one of the, like, tournaments that will always stick with me, because that tournament just involved me having to use, like, everything that was involved in the game to try to win, because, like you guys said, most good lists are built
with... Your raw numbers were terrible.
Yeah, like most good lists are involved with, like, you have this great, great list that have a bunch of solos or units to get you out of different, to do different things, and then they can, like, help you with scenario, attrition, assassination, depending on what you want it for. Like, that tournament for me was very different because I was just short on models to do anything with. Like,
for reference to anyone who doesn't know, Tom Guan basically was not meant to be playing. He was the reserve for the US, I believe.
No, I wasn't even the reserve. I was commentating. But
meant to be commentating. Well, yeah. Pretty much... one of the US people couldn't make it, and he was playing Legion, like, as in he couldn't even leave the country. So Tom Guan got dragooned into basically becoming a representative of the United States, and had to play as best as he could. He was forced to play Legion. He had to play at least one of the casters, which ended up being Pythagrosh. And then they tried recreating his lists, which mostly went running around Warsaw looking for painted Legion models on the night before of the tournament.
Yeah. And so, like, so normally, like, Thagrush 1 was just, like, attrition caster. Like, you like, go to try the 2-for-1 something with your heavies, and then hopefully your feet carries you enough on the attrition edge, and then you win from there. That list could not do that because... it had two heavies. One was a Seraph, one was Typhon. Like, which neither of those trades or gets... You can never trade ahead with any of those models, so that just plan was out of the window. And it was in Primal Terrors, which is a good theme because you have good models access to, like, contest with Hellmouth. You only have one. And you have Warmonger units and, like, usually involve, like, a Blightbringer to buff your warrior models. Did not have a Blightbringer because I had Typhon and Seraph and had... scattering units of warmongers, and it has some fury management solos, which the list never needs because you have, like, heavies that goes up and dies. So when it fills up on fury, you don't need to manage it. So, like, that tournament just involved me having to make very, like, intricate game plans, or obviously my opponent had to, like, cooperate in some manners, otherwise I don't think it could, like, ever work. But, like, you have to give them, like, favorable trades in, like, anything. Like, since most of the time people look at your list, right, and then they're just like, what is wrong with it, and then they ask you some questions about, like, what these models do, and then, like, you just like, okay, so I cannot possibly realistically won an attrition because you don't have the tools for it, and so you have to go to your other route to win. And that tournament was just, like, very, it was actually very interesting for me because I feel like I learned
pretty entertaining for all of us.
Yeah, like, I feel like I learned more in those, like, six games than I could have, like, in, like, even like just a couple of months of play, because normally you will never be put in that situation, right? Like going to important tournaments, nobody builds lists that hemorrhages themselves and then what if I just build a list that decreases my win percentage by like 30%? Like, whoa, how would that feel? Like, I don't think people would do that, but I actually felt like that was really useful, and it gives you a lot. It tests a lot of your skills for they have all fire immune models, and you have a Typhon. What would you do?
Those ones where you try and bait them with Typhon and then kill them with Thagrosh, and I'm pretty sure that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, but no, I just had to switch gear. Which one of the upsides for playing some of these casters that people have assumptions for is that you can really turn the corner on them really fast. So, for example, in that tournament, there were 6 rounds. I won 3 of those rounds on Assassination with Thagrosh. Just because, but based on what I told people about the list, it's just like there was no good targets right in my buffs. So I just put Draconic Blessing on myself, and then just like he went in and did a lot of work. And then that's probably the most models that Thagrosh have ever killed.
Oh, I don't know. That guy, I've played against Jack enough times, especially back in the day. Like Thagrosh does that a lot. Especially because he has a built-in mechanic in the form of his eruption of ash to keep himself safe after he gets some work done. I actually find, with regards to most of these times, so you know what, fuck it, we should get into talking about how to actually dig yourself out of a hole. Realistically, what that even means, because we've used the term a lot. It's called planned shovel. It's you've dug yourself into the ditch. The only way to get yourself out is to keep digging and hope you dig upwards. But it's not necessarily just you're going for the caster, you set yourself up to do this, that sort of thing. What it realistically is, in general good sense to me, game plan of playing War Machine, every turn, try and think about how you can win. Like, is it possible to win this turn? It's a thing that people just forget. Okay, I've got the assassinate. Like, they just completely play their turn. They clocked in. They've sort of clocked out, actually. They're like, oh, actually, if I had just done this and this and this, we're good. I would have won the game. And you're like, yep, you did. You could have, but you didn't. Even just the basis of, the hypothetical. How many, say, if a scenario is on the table and it's particularly live and scoring's about to start, how many points can I get this turn? And what of it? And more importantly, how can I set up, if not to win this turn, then to win next turn? After all, scoring 5 points on most scenarios is pretty hard. Scoring 4 points is much more doable. And oftentimes, if you score 4 points, then you basically have just put them in a kill me or lose situation.
I do that to myself quite often. As in, I will often be looking at the game as, hey, all right, I'm pretty comfortable that I know how this next turn or two is going to play out. We're going to play attrition. I can see how this is going to go. And then opponent comes in, scores 3 or 4, and I'm like, well, I guess I'm killing your caster, because...
Yeah. I do that a lot, too, but in the opposite way. Usually it's like, I'm winning so hard, but let's just do this, and then let's see what they do with it. Like, I throw the most ridiculous games.
And I'm, of course, I'm, of course, the master of setting this up for my opponents so that they then kill me. I will put them in the 4-0 gridlock.
I watched a game very recently where you did this to yourself by going, oh, look, I have all of the Marauders. I can punch huge bases. I can punch them so good. Oh, God, he's scored 4 points.
Yes. I think we all watched that one.
Yes. I got to judge that game. That was not pleasant.
But
the thing there is, even if I had taken scenario off the table, which I was, I obviously didn't, and I should have probably thought about it more, but my logic was actually that even if I take scenario off the table, he's probably going to fucking figure out some dumb way of getting that stupid bird onto my caster, and then, we're still rolling onto it.
I think a good thing to talk about for people to understand is what lead to these situations. For my part, obviously I said I get arrogant thinking about things. So just sometimes for me, it's just when I play a game when my plans are going so well and the matchup is good, the game plan is good, it's I just can't I just stopped thinking about how I could lose, so I just started slipping up. That's my part.
Yeah, you're I don't need to think about this anymore. I'm just gonna knock out a couple of tweets and think about the next game.
Yeah. knock out tweets, ask Chris when's food and stuff like that. Like the game is so far away from you at that point. And then you lose the random 5% of the time that he's like, oh yeah, that does work. Okay, yeah. I don't know about what leads to these situations for you guys, but that's usually what happens with me.
I think I've overconfidenced my way into dying several times. Yeah, that's the thing I've done.
I have definitely done that, as Tom would know.
I would appreciate it if you guys would stop stealing my moves. Thank you very much.
I think the other one that jumps up for me is not just getting my caster killed, but in terms of I have a tendency to sort of fixate on the not die plan. And as a result, yes, I've successfully got my caster not assassinated. I think I've done this for Colin a bunch of times where I'm like, all right, Rosh is really scary. When I was playing Gary 2, we played against, I played into Colin's Rask quite a number of times. I was like, all right, I'm not going to die to Rosh's turn. I'm not going to die to Rosh's turn. And Colin's like, all right, so I scored these 5 points, and I think that means I won the game. I'm like, that's absolutely right. And it's purely because what I've done is gone tunnel vision in terms of I don't like having my shit touched, so I'm not going to let you touch my shit. But I've become so tunnel visioned on that I've also made the out for the game fairly straightforward. It's really important to just, sometimes it is okay to just you don't have to play safe all the time. It's about knowing where the okay trades are going to take place. So that even if it's not a great matchup, you still get to keep playing the game, because then you're still generating opportunities to close it out. Yeah, or at least you can start looking at ways to engineer. It's a semi-shovel play, where you feel like you're really disadvantaged in the matchup. But if I do this, this, and this, then my opponent will respond in kind. And yes, I'm not going to have the opportunity to attrition, assassinate, and scenario them. I'm probably going to wind up with the ability to I'll probably push them into a position where I can probably clear up these 4 points, and then we play one more turn, and then it sort of evens out for me. And it's just learning how it's not a all or nothing play, but it's actually a way to re-equalize the game. Even though things are feeling really bad.
And I always say for most players when they're new, step one in your turn, work out if you're going to win this turn. Mm-hmm. If you're not going to win this turn, step two is work out how you make 100% certain that you don't lose this turn.
Yep.
And that's not always true for higher end play, but I think as a general rule of thumb, if you do those two things as the first two things of your turn, then most turns you'll be able to play the next turn.
It's a good really fundamental skill to have. Sure.
I will say though that don't use this as an excuse to basically counter literally every possible way you could win a turn.
Yes.
And this is something I think is a more practical thing we've done, because a lot of this has been rather theoretical. It's how do you set up an approach to a big turn, that sort of thing? Well, if you've seen most people, they'll generally put their models out of the threat range of the obvious pieces, but of your opponent's army. Your opponent's Colossal has an 11 to 13 inch threat range. Cool. Most of your big important stuff shouldn't be within 13. That doesn't mean it should be that no models should be in 13, unless it's, I don't know, a overtaking Sea King or some shit like that. But knowing exactly when to draw that line and how. Sometimes it's perfectly legitimate not to give your opponent anything, because they have weird fucking rules that allow them to just get wherever they want to. I mean, easy example would be minions with their ability to overtake on anything. Fuck, I've seen a Swamp Horror go on so many adventures. And ends up in so
many. Yeah, usually ends up on my caster for some reason.
Yeah, and you're just like, and more importantly, it pulls you in or does some other shit, and then now more things are now on your caster, and then you're dead, and you're like, how did that happen?
It's also important to think about the models that you kind of want to sacrifice.
Yes.
So, especially when you're playing, and it's very common in the game right now, is vengeance models, is you have to give them an enticing take sometimes, because most people are now very aware, because it's so prevalent in how vengeance works, and they won't just take nothing. So it's also about assessing how many models you think you can give away that becomes a benefit to you, but you think they'll take as a trade. So it becomes a balance of where you think you can So you, it's not always about putting models out of threat ranges, but putting certain amount of models in and out of threat ranges and balancing that, especially when you're playing the bait game.
Yeah. So
when you're playing with Immortals or if you're playing with any of your other Vengeance units, putting the right models in the right place so that the person will actually pick and take that off to get you the extra threat range you need to stay competitive in the game.
Yeah. I mean, Zal is like the look, in a lot of respects, I think Zal too might be one of like the most perfect lists in terms of how things are designed, and just like you literally cover all the bases. You have cheap throwaway recurring trash with Vengeance that is immune to control effects. You have rather, you could generously say, very well costed battle engines that give you a bunch of random meta answers and also just do a shit ton of damage. And in all of that goes tits up, you have the end game in the form of your caster. Plus, your solo package in general is actually quite strong. Like, Hakkar and AGs in general, just getting the +2 strength from a little dude man and then going to town with transference. Like, that will kill a lot of things way above their weight class.
Well, that's their, like, pseudo-lights. But I'm talking also about, like,
I mean, Thorn Planner, similar game,
Not Hearts of Darkness. What's Flames in the Darkness?
Flames in the Darkness, yes.
Yeah, so it's talking about, like, deciding what model do you want to bait with to get your Vengeance attacks, because, I mean,
do you want it, those do you want models... It, it doesn't even have to be, like, you might want your units intact, so then it is a question of, like, do you want to instead use your Archons as your bait pieces? Because that list is extremely well set up to do so, and... A lot of people think they can kill Archons, and then when they run into the laid defense, that it's like Moron Archon plus Hermit plus terrain plus just general spacing, and not to mention control effects, it just all just goes completely pear-shaped. But yes.
A Moron Archon is a very good bait piece, I think, just because it's inherently very hard to remove. So even if people put stuff in, you're probably going to get value in that trade.
Also, it doesn't do much offensively. Yeah, so you don't really mind.
That's what makes it a good bait piece, especially if it's contesting a zone or sitting on a flag that a person can't just let it stand there forever.
From experience,
actually.
It can
just be super annoying.
Yeah, from experience.
If you're playing it in Battle Legends, which is common, like sometimes they can't just let it sit on the table in the off chance that it crits their Battle Engine and makes it useless.
Oh god, that's so funny when that happens.
I think on top of that, just talking on the idea of bait pieces, and this probably gets a little bit more dependent on which cast you're playing and how confident you are in playing the game. But I mean in our sort of local community, you definitely see people become a bit more effective or a little bit more confident when they sort of unlock the ability to know when they can just put their caster up in the middle of the table, almost as like a bit of a bait piece, and it actually being mathematically impossible to, like, take that caster off the table. And they will bait, like, sort of people who are a little bit less certain about the game state into trying to assassinate and not realizing just how impossible it is. I think it really good examples of this is, like, Wormwood is as a caster who's, like, death nothing And like on paper, you're like, oh, this guy should be really easy to kill. And then, like, putting him in the middle of the table with like three transfers and a couple of souls, and your opponent and like a hermit, for example, your opponent like doesn't realize like just how tanky that model is. They put they go, all right, I can get my one heavy to it. They charge their heavy in, and it doesn't like even half kill that caster. And you're like, cool. Well, you functionally force yourself to shovel early on when you really didn't need to, and you've gone for your game-winning play in an environment where that couldn't happen. It's quite a good way. Like I've been doing it a lot with Kruger lately, where
it's actually
he's very hard to kill sometimes.
Sorry,
you go.
It's actually something I find that, and this is something you have to, if you're playing War Machine, you have to be cognizant of, is like, this kind of thing happening where you commit something because you expect it to die, and then you either fuck up on the math or you don't realize that it's just going to be impossible for one reason or another, and then you get tilted, and then your opponent gets lucky by just killing you response, and then you just get angry, and then the rest of the game just goes all tits up. Like, this is, to me, the primary thing that separates, like, a player getting into the game, who's like, you know, getting his feet, and someone who's really actually got the hang of it and is now going to be a good chip and a chance to win a tournament. Because the first kind of player is going to basically blunder into a bunch of situations where they were like, oh, you know, like, this is a good day to do things today. And then, you know, they just walk around, they take a shot, they trigger vengeance, and then a million guys appear from behind walls and forests and shit like that. And then suddenly their army is being eaten by a bunch of Tharn. And they're like, oh, that was bullshit. All right, let me go for the kill. And they're like, well, actually, you can't. And they're like, and then you just get mad and then complain about it on the internet. And then everyone has a good laugh. But what actually happened there was failing to identify the situation in advance. And also, like, it's just one of those things. I mean, here's the thing, though, is, like, I think it's just human nature in general. If you expect something to happen and it doesn't happen for one reason or other, call it bullshit luck or call it just, like, you just getting denied or slapped in the face or forgetting a rule, it might not necessarily be your opponent's fault. It could, in fact, be your fault when you've written countercharge on your hand, countercharge on a card, put countercharge there, like, put as many countercharge models there, and you just move it forward. You move a random guy forward, and then you trigger countercharge.
Yeah, I've definitely never done that.
Yeah.
Me neither. No, me either. Never.
Right? And, like, whose fault is that? It's like, you can't... I mean, you're going to get mad because you're a human being, but whose fault is that, actually? It's yours, right?
It's my fault, sir. That is my fault.
And you just got to wear that, you've got to own it, and just move on. Like, being able to take that step back, think, go, okay, and continue playing your turn. Like, I've seen some people, like, lose the game based on some of the most trivial shit because they just, like, it's not that that thing mattered, it's just, like, I don't know, let's just say, I think I remember...
That feels personal.
I feel personally attacked.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I remember a situation where it was, like, I'm going to say... The Great Bear's charging, like, some kind of... I think it was a hunter or something like that. It wasn't my game, it was someone else playing. But basically, Great Bear's charged a hunter. The Light Jack, all three of them charged the same target. You'd expect to kill it. In the grand scheme of the game, not actually that big a deal. This was against Frawley, because he fucking loved playing that with, like, Haley 2. So think about the situation. You're up against Haley 2, you're being kicked in the face over and over, and you finally get the chance to retaliate, do something. Yes, great. Hunters are def 14. Great Bears back in the day are mat 8. So you need 6s. And guy just gets unlucky. He, like, whiffs 3 of the attacks, right? And then, because by the time he finally hits, not a charge attack, he does some damage. He forgets that you can use precision strike to pick the column to knock out the movement, so the next guy goes in. The fifth attack does, like, he rolls the column again. The sixth attack goes in and misses. And you're just like... So what's actually happened? He's gotten unlucky, then fucked up, and then compounded that mistake, and then as a result of that, he basically missed the chance to kill something that realistically is, you know, statistically unlikely. And then from there, all of this dovetailed, and he basically handed Frawley the game, as I think, I can't even remember what he was playing at the time, it was some Kador shit. It was a shitty Kador caster, so it was probably a Rusk, but, or it was like a Sorcerer or something. But... Yeah, and all of that does come down to human nature, but you do have to take a step back and, yes, get personally attacked from time to time. Hello. Thank you.
I think that actually comes down to, in a lot of cases, practice. Because mm-hmm. the way you learn that you can get out of those situations is by getting out of them once. Yes. And once you've done it once, that lives in your memory as, like, I remember that time when I did that thing, and even though everything was fucked, I still managed to pull out the game, and I felt like I was a legend.
Oh, yeah.
And definitely. That actually inspires you to do it. More, right? Like, oh, it inspires yes. you to go, ah, I can just do this.
Or seeing someone well, else do that, that, like, oh, I could do that. Yeah, that's a cool rule.
I feel like that's, like, Gigantor's entire game plan in most games, is that he knows exactly how hard his stuff is to kill, how much work they can actually do, and then he will put his army in the exact place that makes it, like, a 45% chance that you yeah. might win the game if you go all in right now. And he'll take that risk because in most cases he wins that coin flip.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he only does that because he plays the games and he learns it and he knows exactly how much is work. And, like, I remember when Omodamus was new to the game and people were still learning about him. And I remember he was just like, okay, here's my game plan with this caster, with McKay. I'm just going to run everything forward and see how much work you can do. And if you don't kill my shit, I will win the game the next turn. And he's like, I'm going to find out how likely this is by actually putting it on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he learned.
I also think, and like from personal experience, like one of the biggest areas for development and understanding this particular back end of the game is also learning how to manage your own tilt. Because I am traditionally pretty quick to sort of just throw the towel in for a game.
I've never seen you throw in a game.
No. That I definitely didn't have to. And when I've done well in tournaments is like when I am actually like firing on all cylinders and sort of looking at that, like those bad situations and actively looking at how to sort of get my way out of them. And that's when you win those like really tough games. Like those they aren't tough games because like they're unwinnable. They're usually tough games because like you have to actually do some work to solve problems that are definitely harder than what you would normally encounter in a game. That's probably not quite a redundant and obvious statement. But I like the last, like pretty much since the Super Series last year, which is like November last year, November last year. I've been like really like working on that element of the game, and I mean Vassals helped really like massively for that, and like my like fucks to give as far as the game is concerned, like dropped. That's been really positive, but it also means that I'm managing those situations where like I had a game against Rosie today online, where I like just alphaed Malvern Mayhem like 16 inches onto two champions of the Order of the Wall, and didn't even dismount one of them.
That will happen.
Yeah. It was really cool. And you know, not ideal. And like we were playing Vassal, it was a practice game, so like Rosie like was like, do you want to like take it back? And I was like, I actually don't really care. Like realistically, if this is a piece that I want to include in my like list, then I probably should understand what the list can do when it doesn't work.
Yes.
And that's probably a much healthier way to approach learning to play a list, learning to play the game, is understanding like, you know, when I take this piece out of the list, like when, because realistically you got to account for the fact that like sometimes your model stuff up, but also sometimes like you've got another person playing on the other side of the table.
It's Jack.
Yeah.
That is why I had to learn the same thing for Rosh and Brian. Because Jack got extremely good at making me commit Rosh and Brian into something that I didn't really want to commit into, but I had to because I couldn't afford not to. And so I'd get a good solo for it. I'd get a champion of the Order of the Wall, and I'd get like one other dude because I had to.
Yep.
But then you've got to play the game without it.
And that's... But that's also like that's where you will become better at playing that list, is because you understand how to utilize every element of that list in an effective and meaningful way, and like understanding of like where the limitations of the list lie with the pieces that you do have, and how to work your way around them. Or like if I lose like my one model that can kill a colossal, then how do I play the game around a colossal that is functionally not worth going after?
And like, step one there actually is realizing that you can't kill that colossal, and therefore shouldn't bother, right? And that's actually something a lot of people, like, if you're not really cognizant of it, you just never will go into that. So you'll literally just tunnel vision onto this colossal, and you might actually kill it. You might literally commit every model in your army to kill it, and then you kill it. You feel a vague sense of satisfaction, then your opponent just steps on your caster's face, and that's it. That wasn't the point of the game, right? Like, they've gotten so much more out of that colossal than they ever could have possibly because of you just fucking up like that.
There are games where I've completely had to abandon a normal game of War Machine and play in a completely odd way just to possibly stay in a game because a matchup or a poor decision has changed it, so it put you in that choice. And it doesn't always work out, but like I've had Sorsha 2 in my enemy's deployment zone trying to come at a wall of jacks with a Bart standing behind them so that he could maybe end the game with a speed assassination because I didn't have anything in my list that could kill a bunch of jacks and a galleon. Especially
playing Sorcerer 2, so that makes sense.
I mean, no, Sorcerer 2 back in Mark 2, so yes, it does make sense.
That was Sorcerer 1 at the beginning of Mark 3.
But it's often true, right? Like, particularly if you're playing two lists and you fuck up and the list chicken doesn't go the way you were expecting it to. And you're like, all right, I've got this list. It will cover me for this problem. I kind of have to drop it because I'm pretty sure he won't drop the other list. And then they do because they weren't even thinking about it. And you're like, well, shit.
Yeah,
yeah,
when
you but
get
you can't drop
like that
list because my other list counted it so fucking hard.
And then they turn around and say, like, what, really? It's like, no, I just beat it. You're just like...
You're like, no, no, I reckon I could have played that. And you're like, oh God.
Oh,
but yes, yeah. That definitely does happen, right? And you've got to be able to think about what you're going to do if you've bought your infantry clearing list and your opponent is playing like a normal list with three or four heavies. Not their whole list is heavies, but they've got more than your list can deal with, and you know it going in.
So I think just to go approach this topic from a different angle, because it's funny you brought up Jack earlier, and also I guess Rosie as well, because they're playing red off. It's specifically, how do you find yourself playing these kind of other lists, which are like, because you know, Menoth in general is not exactly it's probably still one of the strongest factions in the game. I'd comfortably put them in the top three, but they're not exactly the kind to alpha you or do any of those kind of like tricks. Like, they're not a faction with access to Void Archons, to Alexia, to I don't know, whatever. Like, their tech piece is basically Fire of Salvation, who's a Menoth Archon glued to a Crusader. That's
that
like
you see very, very sometimes. Like, I mean, their tech piece is actually the ability to intrinsically, like, over the course of the game, suck your soul out of your body.
Yeah, and stop like you commit.
Make you hate life.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, that's Chim Plan A through Z, right?
Yeah. And it's just like, how do you successfully suck the life out of someone? Because other factions can...
Spiritual attrition.
It's like a Yu-Gi-Oh situation.
I will not want to play anymore.
I find Menoth as a faction just plays very similar to how Zal 2 plays.
Yeah.
Where, yeah, that's
the whole fucking way.
But the whole faction does it, so it's really hard. And the thing is, they're also slightly faster than a Zal 2 list in a lot of ways. So you also have to, like, sometimes with Zal, it's better to just stay back because he won't usually be able to take a scenario lead in a very strong sense if you just back up for a turn. Sometimes backing up, giving him one or two points because that's all he can get with how slow his list is a better choice. With Menoth, they're fast enough where they can blitz that scenario if you back off too hard, or they'll if you go in to protect it, they have high enough threat ranges where they can just nail you off the table.
It sounds like you're almost describing a faction that is inherently busted and overstated.
Menoth. Beautiful faction. So many beautiful things.
Yes, brought to you by the power of spite. Yes. But anyway, I think that it's very important. Like, and I think Menoth is almost like has created a sort of side game compared to the traditional factions, and I think that Infernals and Grimkin to an extent mimic this in that we were joking only half seriously about the fact that their game plan is to suck the soul out of your body and make you hate life.
No, we weren't joking.
But like those factions' game plan is to basically just like everything trades really efficiently, and none of it's really easy to remove en masse. Like, you very rarely would be able to blitz out a Faithful Masses list. So then you wind up with this scenario where you need to understand what losing that game looks like. Because losing that game is very different to, like, losing to, McKay list. Or like a Crystal Guard list where, like, they're just going to blitz your army off the table and you'll know when you're down
McKay.
To 20...
McKay kills me. Yes.
McKay showed me exactly what 20% of my army now looks like on the table. So, like you won't necessarily get that with a Menoth or Grimkin or Infernals list. You won't suffer those huge blitzes, but you also, you might feel like you're still in the game, but you're definitely not. Mm. Like, this happens against Jack. This happens to me against Jack all the time, where I'm like, oh, I think you could play, and realistically, like, Jack is a much better player than I am, and we'll just... like quite candidly just be like, no, I think this game like ended about a turn or two before this. And I just hadn't failed to identify that had happened at that point. So I think understanding how, like, having good knowledge of the game and having good knowledge of what you're playing against is quite crucial to identifying how that game finish. Because if you don't, then you are just going to get the accidental beaten.
Yeah. And you don't know when to shovel.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Same problem. You don't know that you're in a position where you should be taking long shots because you haven't recognized that you're actually out of the game.
Yep.
And this is actually one of those things, like, I find Menoth is actually probably one of the best factions for doing this, where they just compound, like, they compound all of these just statistically hard to calculate and just kind of annoying situations on top of each other, and then they wait for you to make a mistake, right? Mm-hmm. Or just, you know, not even just got unlucky, although that definitely factors in as well. Like, in your example, killing a champion of the Order of the War. Look, honestly, Malvin and Mayhem could roll maximum damage on every one of their attacks, hit with everything, roll max damage, and they still might not kill those two champions of the Order of the War. Or, like, because they have tough, right? And they have other mechanics as well, right?
Things like that.
Also, and this can be even more dickish, those guys have retaliatory strike. I don't know if, like, Rosie did that against you, but let's just say you hit them, they retaliatory strike, and between the two of them, they rip off your big arm, and you're just like,
yeah.
Gee, thanks. Well, yeah. Shit.
Yeah. Well, shit. And then something else goes wrong, and then it just another domino falls. Mm-hmm. And you're like, you only kill one, right? And then that means that triggers righteous vengeance on everything.
Oh wait, you were trying to kill two of them, were you?
Yeah.
I charged two of them, and I didn't even dismount one of them.
No. Yeah. I gave up on charging more than one of them, like, after the third time I tried it with a heavy that was, like, power 22.
Look, in the full context of the game, Malvin and Mayhem had already taken about 12 boxes of damage, or 11 boxes of damage, and thankfully had only lost, like, one of the arms. And, like, there's no repair option, so I was like, look, I can get onto these two guys. Yeah, like, best case scenario, I dismount both of them and leave them at that, because then you're not triggering anything. And that was sort of the plan. It was like, just dismount and then you're okay. And even if you don't dismount both, like, dismount one, you still have the ability to, like, I might still be okay. But dismounting zero was like, yeah, like, look, it wasn't ideal. I think
it was not an ideal outcome. It wasn't the optimum outcome.
No, it wasn't. But also, like, that was also a moment where I had to turn around and, like, I mean, Rosie being the gracious, awesome person that he was just like, dude, like, we'll just do it in terms of, like, as if, because all the attacks had hit.
Right.
Yeah, and I just rolled, like, double ones on all of the damage rolls.
Yep.
Functionally was where that activation landed. He's like, look, in the realm of seriousness, like, you dismounted at least one of them. So we played it from there. But it's still, like, you got to play, like, you do have to play out those games where you don't get the value out of your activations that you wanted to. Because if you don't, like, you're never going to be, like, able to grow as a player. You just sort of, like, it's almost like playing, like, rocking up to a poker table, like, and I'm going to use a Chris analogy here, rocking up to a poker table, sure, not looking at your first hand, going all in, and then being really sad when it didn't pan out for you. You're setting yourself up for failure. Especially if that's the expectation that you're walking into that interaction with.
Yeah, I mean, fair. It's more like basically like, yeah, sure, that's one way of looking at it. I mean, the other thing too to me is that when you look at it, everyone sort of calculates things for their averages. Like, you know, you're always going to roll 7 on 2d6, right?
Yes, which is not the case. Not,
like,
even close.
2d6 is not also 50%. It's like 57-ish%, right? But,
yeah,
you know, like, it's not unlike, it's slightly leaning more towards on the safe side, but that does mean that if you're banking on a 7, right, you've still got, like, 4 in 6 chance of not rolling that 7. Sorry, 4 in 10 chance of not rolling that 7 like you need it.
Yep.
And you might, your damage output is never going to be, like, a nice consistent line. It will be over the period of your entire lifetime if you play a lot of War Machine, but you're going to get times where you go, like, the next time Malvin and Mayhem go in a completely different game, it could be, like, 12s and 11s for days.
Yes.
And then what are you going to do? You got to also know how to exploit that situation where Malvin and Mayhem don't dismount both champions. They kill both champions.
Or you get onto a Colossal, like, onto the Victor, and, like, they just roll very high on their power 20 attack and actually just kill it over the course of 5 attacks.
Yeah.
You will have those games where it goes really well. You'll also have those games where it doesn't. It's very important to understand that you will have an experience of both of those throughout the time of playing the game. Not everybody can win every game.
Damn. No.
Incidentally, the poker analogy you're looking for is you're going for a flip. And
oh my god, Chris. I was, Oh my god.
This was coming. You literally walked into that.
Yes, no.
You were like, let me just provide Chris with a setup, and then, oh god, Chris. No,
shame on me.
Shame on me.
That was terrible Chris moderation right there.
You should know who you're talking to.
Sorry. Yeah, I know. I'm really sorry to all listeners involved in this podcast.
I didn't know the name of the title today. Hey, look. to pocket twos, okay? This shit just happens.
Oh my god. Okay, so moving on. So moving from here, do we feel like we've covered shoveling well enough at this point?
I actually think what we should go into more is identifying the casters and solos that are good shovel pieces. Specifically, what are their common trends? Because we've gone into a couple of the examples, right? Like Malvin and Mayhem, like, I mean, I wouldn't really call them a shovel piece, I guess. Rosh and Brian, sorry. Like Void Archons. Alexia probably goes in there as well, because what is a Dark Guidance class without an Alexia, right?
Aurora 1.
Like Aurora 2 is fucking whole kit. Aurora 1, yeah, that sort of thing. Like, what exactly do they all sort of have in common, and why are they good enablers? I mean, Thagrush 1 as well. We can't forget your good work, Tom.
Lord of the Thieves is just like you can't... piece for this.
Yes, sometimes.
It just, for me, it's just like something that can precisely destroy one model.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, most of the time when you're like shoveling, it's like, well, I've lost everything, and then you have to like pull out, like do some anime moments, start to like try to kill the villain while the dude's like behind like three layers of units, Warjack and Solos, and then like usually something like that. Like in my case, it's like, let me mutagenesis this bot or this servitor, and then have Dagger chop access to this, or like let's veil feet and then throw like a bunch of spells at Siege 1. It's like something that like when everything is lost that you can still have like your like back pocket gun to just try to win the game that way.
And normally what they have in common is the ability to reach out and touch beyond, like if you commit them fully, the ability to reach out and touch beyond what the rest of your list can do.
And
the potential to hit a high roll always helps.
Also, generally speaking, somewhat of a non-linear angle to it. Yep. There should be something, like, because people can, like, no one is ever in the history of War Machine dying to Butcher One, right? Like, it's just not going to happen unless they literally
I feel a bet coming along, Chris.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, like, the simple fact is you stay literally 10.1 inches away from him, 12.1 if they have Sorcerer Zero, and it's impossible for him to charge you, so then... What is it? It's also stuff like...
The day comes where Colin decides to kill something that's within 10.1 inches of him and has sprint, and Colin doesn't trigger sprint because he doesn't kill the thing, and then he gets charged by Butcher One and dies.
I mean, when that game happened, that was still your fault. In fact, that was 100%.
Hey, you didn't say that it wasn't allowed to be your fault. You just said no one's ever died to him.
Okay, fine. That's fair.
I think,
in my case, thinking a Hellbound would stop Butcher from charging and then have a random dude next to you and then Butcher charge that guy instead.
Yes.
The old one too.
I mean, this actually is a reason for me that, say, casters like, say, Kane 2 and 3, or even Kara Sloan, actually, aren't good assassins. Like, they're good at destroying your entire army, that's fine. But in terms of actually killing casters, oftentimes they're not the best. But someone like Kruger 2 is like the master of randomly just gatting you from some ridiculous angle. And let's not forget Grail, like Colin, your favorite fucking guy. Just his ability to just randomly pull some shit out, and then all of a sudden there's a Lord of the Feast on your caster. You don't know how this happened, it just happened. Right?
Yeah, and they are pieces that... And Lord of the Feast, as Tom said earlier, is a piece that can, if you are willing to commit it fully because you have nothing left to lose, can take roles that it wouldn't have taken otherwise. So it can take a Raven shot at something where it needs a 9, because you know that you need it, and if you don't roll it, well, shit, the game's already lost. But if you do roll it, hello, suddenly there's a Lord of the Feast in a place where they really weren't expecting Lord of the Feast to land, because nobody in their right mind would take that 9 on a normal turn.
On a normal turn.
Also, the common theme of all these models is whatever happens, regardless of whatever happens, one of you or your opponent is not happy.
Yes.
Yes.
There's going to be disappointment. Someone somewhere is going to be disappointed.
Yeah. If you're really looking for these models that can help you dig out in a bad situation, just look for models with very high variance in their turns. Like, for example, a Trollkin champion is the very, like, a staple model. It goes forward, takes some shots, and then sometimes do some damage.
Did you say a Trollkin champion?
Yeah, I did. I have to bring trolls in every time I podcast from now on.
All right.
It's a very funny way to pronounce some sort of sponsorship.
I mean, I'm going to just say, like, yeah, fantastic.
Actually,
Trollkin
yes, I have
champion,
troll,
staple
yeah,
model
I,
of War Machine. You heard it here first.
I have trolls model to sell, so I'm technically... So if they ever
Dark
get good,
sponsored by trolls.
Actually, that's kind of true. But yes, but regardless of what happens in the Trollkin champion's career, it's like nothing too exciting will happen, like with it or against it. But for example, some models that would till the living, like Lord of the Feast is the perfect one. It's like sometimes if you double once the bird, you just want to flip the table.
Oh yes.
Right, like, there's probably some other ones I'm thinking I forgot, but, like, that is my favorite example to think of.
So, it's funny you say that, because I think this is, when you're constructing lists for this, like, that have these kind of high variance pieces, every faction has access to puppet strings. I mean, they simply do. Like, Eilish will give it to them, and in some cases, they've got it in their theme itself. Like, Chuck Dongwood giving it out, Colden Lords for,
Can we call the podcast Chuck Dongwood giving it out?
Doug Chuckwood? Yes.
Yeah.
He gives it all out. That hobo has got it for days. But yeah, like, there are ways to get it. If nothing else also, if you've got nothing better to do with your objective, and you think that you might end up going for some kind of sketchy play, fucking
go nuts. Get yourself a special super reroll.
Yeah, get that fucking treasure chest in there. The treasure chest is your friend for setting up the most unlikely of plays. Nines of the rerolls, about a coin flip, and it's going to be equally tilting to your opponent when you pull it off. And then, of course, like, when you do go in there, you have a damage roll to save. And there's nothing worse than actually nailing the nine like a boss, because you're good at the game.
Also, just
using the reroll, and then
to,
using the reroll instead to reroll an attack roll in their caster.
Yeah, also bring it back to Jack for just very briefly. Yes. His lists are all very static. There's nothing exciting that ever happens with it. It's like, oh, I rolled very below average, your whole army died. Mm.
Yeah, I know. I rolled
unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's the Menoth way, isn't it? Like the most
no, I think...
Most,
no,
looks
all
like you failed to roll massively above average. I guess you lose this game.
Wow, you're so shit at War Machine.
No, Brian, I think it's... Every time I play against Jack, it always feels that way. Like, his list never needs to roll well, and I have to roll really well.
Yep.
I mean, it's explicitly why he loved Kryos 3, right? Is because he's a caster where, you know, like, he does, like, realistically, not a ton for the list, all, like, on a 10x10 basis. He, like, swaps Ignite around, or the Arcane, whatever it is. But then, like, just having watched Jack play... I don't see much delight in a player like basically putting his caster out, being like, "My like just pretty boring. Like it's just gonna walk forward, punch, probably not die to whatever you do." My caster is amongst that. Like my caster is up the table. You can put like a heavy onto him, and there is zero way that guy's like that Kryos is gonna die. So he's very good at like generating opponents like need to shovel when like it isn't there. And when your whole army is like overstated and boring as fuck to begin with, like turns out cleaning up like shovel plans is pretty easy.
Well,
yeah,
I mean,
it just tells me because I love
Kryos 3's whole shtick to me is that he is actually just impossible to kill. He literally
don't ever do it.
No, and it's like if you do get it, like it's usually a situation of jokes. Actually, it was a trap. You weren't able to like Man, that guy is such a bastard for that. Because of Arcane Ward, you can't spell him. Because of initiates in general, you generally can't shoot him. And because of his position...
Stupid guard dog idiot.
Yeah,
That guy's gone, at least, so that he's slightly more killable.
Unless you're playing him in, like, Warriors of the Old Faith, and then say hello to a Def 18 Kryos with an actual guard dog.
Yeah.
And yeah, like, at that point, like... Your list is... The reason why, incidentally, for anyone paying attention, Do you guys think that, and I at least think this, Krellstreem might be just the best Menoth caster because of specifically the fact that the Menoth list is already so efficient, it just doesn't need anything else. So you might as well just literally take one aspect of the game entirely off the table and kill 2 to 3 heavies with your caster.
In a world where high reclaimer isn't relevant, I think Krios 3 is number one.
That's a crime, by the way.
Yes.
Maybe you should nerf the faction because of
Definitely needs to nerf the faction.
I also, to be fair, Krios 3 comes with an extremely good mini feat, and that mini feat is that once per game, he can bring Fire of Salvation for the rest of the game onto the table. Yes. Actually, it isn't really a mini feat. It's more like a permanent feat, upgrade your army. Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's just that, like, you've got a cast. Like, I mean, and one of the good things about a cast like Krios or like McKay is that, like, they, like, worst case scenario, if you've lost your whole army, you still kind of have a heavy on the table. Like, because they will just drop. Like, they don't have the need to go kill a caster because they can still trade, like, right through to the end of turn 7 themselves.
And there's
they're a butcher 3.
Yeah. Butcher 3 and Karchev can do that. There's a kind of a big difference, I think, between, like, say, the Butcher 3 types and the Karchev, because, say, McKay, Krios 3, and Karchev, I'd say, can spend down all their focus, kill a heavy, and still be quite safe. Like, Krios has Repo and generally high stats. McKay is literally a battle engine with, and like, as long as she has any amount of focus left over, she's probably good to go. And Karchev has, like, overstatted is an understatement.
Unlimited number of health.
Yeah.
Yes.
36 and armor 21 with def 12. You're just like, oh my fucking god. Right? Butcher, on the other hand, if he does spend down, he's actually at the point you can kill him.
Yeah, it's not very hard to kill at that point. Sure. Yeah.
It's still hard. Let's not get carried away. It's too hard.
Yeah, but it's a lot better than, say, like, one other other caster spending down, failing to kill something, and then you just squash them.
Yes, it is better than lots of the other options now.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
This segment brought to you by Tilt.
Oh, man, yep.
Yeah, kill Krios 3. Lots of times.
I think that was just a simultaneous pause.
I've killed them too, also, but I just get angry every time I have to play against Krios.
Yeah. And again, it's not really Krios himself, it's more the combined package of army and everything, but he's just such a good false multiplier for that. Either way,
most of the time it's Jack.
Yeah, I think it's Jack.
I think that's actually the problem here. Yeah.
Possibly.
Because I've definitely killed Krios 3 run by other people many times.
Yes.
Jack's very good at gauging exactly where that model can stand and just survive.
Well, that's actually a good point as well in general. If you're playing War Machine, especially, and this is probably where we go into the solos department here, although it still applies to casters. When you have a bunch of high-impact solos, like, as I said, like, good examples being Void Archons, Alexia, and, honestly, Lord of the Feast, even, Wolfrider Champions.
Tankers.
These kind of really flexible models, oftentimes, playing them appropriately is a balancing act between getting work out of them in the mid-game, like, early to mid-game, so to speak, and then also knowing, like, saving them still for the end game or just some kind of big play. Like, played a game against Whaley where I basically saved up my Void Archon specifically to try and kill Gerlach. Ended up fucking up, but that was okay. Whaley missed his charge attack anyway, so all happy days. But and avoided killing my entire Doom Reaver list. But, I literally specifically had a Void Archon earmarked to kill one model in his army. But then the other one was basically, like, flittering around and making sure. Now, that game, actually, I took a pretty commanding lead, but it was the one where it came down to one kill point between the two of us. And it was really, to me, down to one difference. I lost both my Void Archons. He kept his in the game. And his one, just every turn, would just, like, go in and spray some guys and boost a couple of things and get their souls back. He just kept that guy in the game literally the entire time. Eventually, that Void Archon was what he used to basically make sure I couldn't win on scenario, so we went into this weird killbox situation, right? And that was because he was able to play it better. He was able to screen it more with all these trolls in the way, and it just fit his game plan more. And I missed my shot in order to kill it. Like, I literally feed it to try and kill one of the Void Archon. I went for something different instead. I think his Leviathan, and that proved to be a mistake. So yeah, a lot of like playing these solos and stuff is about using their tricks. Now, a lot of it comes down to, I think, any model with reposition, I find, is just inherently going to be extremely good at staying alive by exploiting just, you know, positioning, being able to juke around terrain, that sort of business. A lot of models are able to reach out and basically kill anything that's 10 inches away from them. That's really easy. But killing something that's 13 inches away, which is a range 10 model with repo 3, that's actually quite a bit harder. And then as you start making that number higher and higher, or you get more dramatic things, like, say, obviously the big one to me is like avoid archoning, jumping after killing some stuff. Jumping 8 inches is fucking huge.
I think you touched on a spot there that I'd go back to, which is in both your list and your opponent's list, being able to identify the pieces that give that list flexibility, if there are any, and that are therefore points of failure for that list. So if you can take pieces of flexibility out of an opponent's list and leave them with only one game plan, then obviously the game becomes one-dimensional. And assuming you can win against that game plan, then you have effectively won the game.
Yes.
And being able to hold on to pieces because you recognize that even though you're being offered a really good trade for that piece and it's going to trade up, you're going to lose an aspect of your game plan for future turns that will enable your opponent to win. That's really hard. So knowing when you can't commit your, for example, Lord of the Feast, even though he's going to get, you know, twice, three times his points, but you can't because you know that it's the only thing keeping you in that aspect of the game. And once he's off the table, you now have to play an honest game and you're going to lose that even though you're up 6 or 8 points because of the trade.
Let's be honest.
Recognizing that is hard.
Yeah. Let's be honest. The only people who actually are good at Honest War Machine are Meloths and Jacks. So, yeah. The rest of us have to be dishonest and cheat and try and get our way around things.
You're pretty good at Honest. But okay. If out of the five of us, I'm the worst at playing Honest War Machine. That's usually how I lose games.
Chris, you make your life like you're in most of your games not playing Honest War Machine.
Yeah, but is it really honest when it always just seems to end up with me just like, all right, you know, I've just set up this tool. I've just set up like an anime villain, this elaborate puzzle for you as the plucky hero to just kill me in the face with. Is that really honest?
Yes, you're playing honest. You're just evil. Right. Lawful evil.
Fair enough. All right.
I'm glad someone's finally said it.
You got me there. Damn.
But yes, I think Tom, you're right. I think there's some people here who play more honest and less honest, and I think it depends on, in a lot of cases, it depends on the list, right? So
Brian's probably the most honest because I have never seen Brian kill any caster.
Well, that's not true. But I played Kator, that was half my game plan with Sorsha. Also, that's how I win with Zaltu.
Yeah, like,
if I can't win Nutrition.
I've seen Brian kill plenty of people with Zaltu, even when he has a comfortable attrition lead, just because he wants to go have lunch.
Yeah. The only time I see Brian play is Trolls or Omodemos. So, that's...
Yes, neither of those are very good at that.
Yeah, so
I haven't figured out Agathon yet, or haven't.
Yeah. But one of the upside of the random thing is, like, when I just, like, focus on assassinations, like, it randomly helps me attrition. Just, like, because for, like, setting up assassinations is all about, like, planning how to focus your whole list to put as much damage on one model as possible. So, like, one of the skills I pick up is, like, really good at clearing out, like, lanes. But sometimes there's no kill on the table, right? Because like they're just like they check, they spend 10 minutes measuring, like, all right, I'm out of every possible range. It's like but that skill is still good. It's like, all right, I can, but like it's translatable to scenarios. Like, all right, I need to remove that four of those things from this zone, and you're like really good at it. Like, I think focusing on assassination can help you improve your target selection because that's the name of the game.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, assassinating four models to win the game is still the, more or less an assassination win. It's just you win on scenario instead of caster kill, right? Like,
yeah. But like that, yeah. I think the point was like, it's actually good for attrition too, because unless even like it doesn't like directly lead to a win on this turn, it can still help you win later turns. Like, all right, I need, let's say like you don't like, I need to assassinate like the guy that gives out Atlas Sight. I need to kill Lord of Feet, and you kill like these two like. These two models that can potentially contest in the next two turns. So, like, target selection is, like, one of the key attributes of, like, succeeding assassination. Just,
or even just playing War Machine in general. Like, if you play, the more games you play, the more you identify, honestly, the pieces worth killing in with what order. Especially if you play into a list or even a faction at some point in time. And you get completely hosed by a model. You'll learn very quickly. Whether you get the chance to or not to actually kill that model is a different story. But that's what the game comes down to, is like how you can force that kind of bad decision onto your opponent.
Yeah, I guess the thing that's sort of different on this specific topic is around that factor of what a model gives a person in terms of options rather than raw power. So if you're killing, most people can identify quite well models that they need to kill because those models will kill lots of their models, and that's most often it will be things like their heavies, etc. But recognizing the pieces on the opponent's list that are critical to giving them a range of options rather than making them very good at an option they're already very good at, that's a knack, and being able to protect those pieces in your own list and recognize what they are and make sure that you don't trade them out when you can't afford to, that's a skill that I think is worth people practicing.
I would also say, like, especially if you're not necessarily something you do at a tournament, but if you're in a practice game, practice being greedy. Like, actually practice with one of those pieces that has a high potential impact, and just work out for yourself how far you can push it and into what opponents. Like, and it's really worth, like, trying it, seeing how you go. Like, just be that little bit extra greedy with your Void Archons because you think you've mapped it out. And if you fuck it up, okay, that's why it's a practice game, right? And even then, you might have lost your Void Archon. Cool. See what happens when you, like, how you play still with your options diminished.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And being able to... So I guess the flip side of the shovel, and I don't know that we have a word yet for what it is, but the flip side is those situations where you have a high variance piece and there is an opportunity to try for a high result. And if you get that high result, to turn that into a quick win rather than not take that chance and work your way towards a slow win.
Well, what you... you mentioned before we started this cast, you wanted to bring up a topic which I think is probably relevant to right now, which is specifically, like, when is it actually the right time to look for those kind of plays? To, like, even if you're ahead on attrition, or even if you look like you're going to win on attrition as a result of the way this game looks like it's going, when is it still the time to try and pull the trigger or look for opportunities to do so?
Yeah, and it's a weird one because I think... And I don't know if it's immediately sort of generalizable to everyone, but when I was learning to play and when I, through my, I guess, career, for lack of a better word, there were portions during that period. And one of the phases that I went through was a like, all right, I am focused on slowly and steadily winning the game. And because I was focused on slowly and steadily winning the game, I didn't give myself the opportunity to have high results occur. And the caster that actually changed me back out of that was Morph 2, because Morph 2 gave you the opportunity to have a go at those all the time for free, right? Which meant
I believe
that,
the term is high roll, incidentally.
Yeah, which just meant that in games when you were playing her, you could afford to chance your arm at stuff because you had this fallback of, well, I'm always going to get another go and I'm always going to get to bring back my army and I'm going to get to do all these other things. So that caster... made me explore a different aspect of the game. And then I sort of took that into other casters further on to sort of go, well, yes, if I play this and it goes wrong, I'm not going to be as far ahead as I was. And maybe I'm going to get back to even. But if I play this and it goes right, this game is going to close out and I'm not going to be in turn six with fucking no time on the clock trying to work out how to shovel my way out of this fucking bullshit again when I thought I had it won. Right? Because being up by one control point, that you are technically winning that game. But you could also be going down to a game where it's turn seven, you're still up by one control point, maybe you're not up by one control point anymore, and both of you have got 3 minutes on your clock, and now it's sort of, who knows who's going to end up winning that game. And you don't have to go to that point. Like, if you're up by a little bit, you can trade that up by a little bit for a shot at winning, and go back to being even if it turns out that you don't win. And that's not a bad trade to make a lot of the time, particularly in tournaments if you know that you are going to have to play four games that day or five games that day. Like, playing them all down to the wire, unless you're Chris, is just not that's not a functional strategy for most players. Like, it's just
all right, I think you've just convinced me I'm not an honest player after all. Thank you.
But that's actually something that I found the more tournaments I played, the more I found that being able to win a game early and get out of that round and not have to worry about that round anymore and be more time to prepare for the next round, that's actually really valuable.
That's huge.
It's worth the chance of – it's worth increasing incrementally the chance of you losing the current game if the upside of winning or the upside of coming out royal is so much higher.
So
I would – I kind of went about it the opposite way. I went from playing trolls – and only doing the grind fest for so long, and then moving into Kator and going into Sorsha 1 and learning there was this entire other aspect of the game, which was crazy assassination vectors and control aspect, that it just kind of improved the way I kind of saw the game going forward. But you didn't have the one path to victory in every case. So I
think...
kind of understand what you're going for.
Well, I can give another example that why you'd want to take such a shot beyond just, like, I want to get a coffee and get a rest, right? Like, and let me be blunt, right? I drink a lot of coffee. I'll happily go and try and go for an assassination run if I'm really fucking dying to get coffee. Fair enough. But probably a more realistic thing is if your opponent has honestly got those kind of pieces that we've been alluding to earlier that could just get, like, fracking spike real high and just fuck you up. Like, you might, let's just say you get a 50-50 or even like a 55-45 and your opponent also has Lord of the Feast, but you're still technically ahead. You might go for that. You might not go all the way full, but you might go for it simply because you can't guarantee that you'll still maintain that lead once, like, Lord of the Feast goes in and just tears a bunch of shit up. And that's just using him as an anecdotal example. There are a lot of cases where it might be better. This might actually be the best chance you get simply because of how the rest of the game will possibly play out. It's you're mitigating risk one way or another. Either you're risking rolling bad now or you're risking your opponent rolling well later. It's not always one of the things we talk about generally, though, but I like it as a subject. How about you guys?
I hate playing honest.
Well, I mean, that was great.
And
just not even talking
air.
About playing honest. Dead air. Lovely.
Yeah.
Tomo, are you there?
I am, sorry.
All good.
Yeah.
I think you can probably bring something into this regarding how, like, Kruger also factors into this kind of thing, because...
I mean, it's why I like him, and it's why I'm, like, very clued into him as a car, or not clued in, but, like, very attracted to him as a caster, is because he's sort of like the ultimate toolbox for all the problems that we've been talking about. Like, he's fairly low risk as far as, like, committing to one game plan. Like, he's a caster that's not sort of married to just scenario, just attrition, just assassination, but he's quite capable of playing all three into a wide range of different matchups. And I think that if you, like, and me as a player, like I've jumped around, and typically I wind up coming to TK casters because I really, really, really enjoy that element of the game. But it's also because, like, and TK is, like, obviously considered one of the most powerful spells in the game, because it's so impactful both to correct mistakes but also to set up bigger plays than would be there otherwise. And I think that that's really, really important, particularly when you're, like, when you've got a matchup that might seem a bit more difficult, like having that, like, a cast that can generate that sort of edge. But also, like, his toolkit kind of allows the ability to expose weaknesses very, very quickly. And I think that when you are looking for casters, like, it's quite important to consider how easily, yes, there are some raw power casters, and, like, I would say, like, Iona is a really good caster. She's a very good caster at making sure that hard, like, things that are hard to kill get killed.
Yep.
But she's not necessarily the sort of caster that goes, like, all right, we're down to the bottom of sixth, or down to the top of seventh, and I've got no way out of this game except for killing their caster, when she's got, like, a pseudo, like, she's got a bit of a threat extender, but that relies on you then hitting their caster with, like, a spell and things like that. And she's not generating those big numbers anymore. You've got a cast that actually has some very big weaknesses into finding outs in the game that are outside, like, their normal strategy.
I mean, so, Iona, yeah. Basically, you actually can out-dice her. Like, it's hard to imagine it, because I know that Iona is extremely strong, but you can just completely fuck her by rolling better dice than she does, because your cast is good, or your list is set up for that sort of way, or you're really able to blunting things.
Yes, and she's a very safe caster for people, like, for newer people to the faction, or newer people to the game, because, like, what she does is very, like, objectively powerful. But it's also very linear, and I think that, like, all of us, like, all the casters we've been talking about in this game, on this podcast, the, like, the ones that we're attracted to, whether it be Rask in Colin's case, Vlad 2 in your case, Zal 2 on Brian's case, like, Crew 2 in mine, like, we tend to, like, yes, they... You know, they're all very different, but fundamentally, at the end of the day, what they are really good at doing is, like really exacerbating problems in what the opponent's done, and generating high value, opportunities, and maximizing the use out of pieces.
Going back to Colin's topic just thing, and I think we should wrap up soon anyway. It seems like as good a point as any. Kruger 2 is literally one of the top casters, I'd say, that, like, if you ever get, like, a 50-60% chance against him, honestly speaking, unless you know that he's, like, unless you're really confident, go ahead and take it. Because even though, like, dice and math will, like, there's no luck factor involved. It's a simple fact that the longer a lot of these kind of models are left on the table, the better chance that you have to accidentally lose the game.
Yep.
And whether how that comes about, you might not be able to foresee. Like, it will probably be very context sensitive. Like, you walk out, you basically commit to a play, and all of a sudden Kruger goes and does his walk, then TK, and then lightning bolts you three times in the face. Yep. Like, these can happen. And I find that if you want to try and pull the plug on a game early, it's almost a case of you're basically going for the play where you don't think that the risk of him being able to bullshit something out later in the game is worth it.
Yeah.
I'd say also, incidentally, like, yes, TK is one of those amazing spells. And casters like that are pretty much... Casters that set up in general... Casters able to fix numbers and also do positioning well generally tend to, like, stick it well as in the game of War Machine.
Well, I mean, if you look at the top casters in most factions, that's sort of what they're bringing. Like, Scar 3 in Krix does it. Kruger 2 does it. Fiona does it. You go down the list, and like, even Zal 2 has, like, his Righteous Vengeance bullshit all over the table.
Yes.
Like, that positioning trickery is really does seem to be that, like, one of the elements that enables these casters that just get stronger as the game goes on tend to possess.
It's also one of the elements that lets you have these sort of shovel-type plays,
yep.
Right? It's just having options on the table that the caster brings that let you do something that your opponent then has to have also thought about, and it makes your opponent work around something that you're not planning on using most of the time. So you end up consuming their ability to process and also forcing them back, even though you're never intending to do the thing until the turn that you are intending to do the thing.
Yeah.
And that's a hallmark of most of the good casters, is that in some way, shape, or form, they can kind of put your opponent in a position where you have to work around something that is not actually going to happen, but you have to work around it because it definitely will happen if you don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll only happen if you give me the chance to make it happen. So it's the absolute worst of all possible worlds, because, and I know a couple of people do this, like Jack definitely does this, is like, by existing, my list forces you to make all the bad choices, and then whatever makes you go like a fucking fussy little teacher, he goes like, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, and all those things are dead.
Yep.
All right, try again, please.
Wanderer also does that. But
yep. Runderer is extremely good at doing that, yes.
Grimkin do it all the time, right?
Yep.
Sacrifice is like that in a can. It's like here's a choice for you. If you fuck it up, you lose the game. And it's there every turn. And yep. I'm not going to play it until the turn that you fuck it up, and then you're going to lose the game.
Yep. Yep. Clocks and their blinking is exactly the same concept, right? Like, here is a heavy, you can come to it, but you better do it like perfectly, otherwise you don't get the heavy, and I totally capitalize on what you've just tried to do.
And even if you do it perfectly, I probably still get two of your heavies.
Massively. Absolutely.
Oh, man. Do you like good choices? Well, you're not going to like me. I've got nothing but bad choices for you.
Came to the wrong job.
Yep.
Yeah. And sometimes in that case, it's just better to go for the throat. All right.
Yep.
I think we're going to call that a wrap, though. Honestly speaking, just if your list you find in general is just not that flexible enough, look at adding those kind of flex pieces in there. They're typically merc slots. They're typically the kind of better themes. They're typically just fun shit to play around with in general. Like, God knows, if playing around with a Thamorite or a Void Archon just in general feels sweet as, right? Do it more. It's good.
They're a fun model.
Yeah.
Not a fair model, but they're a fun model.
Oh, they're definitely not a fair model, but I think we've been talking about fair models.
Yeah.
No, despite our best efforts, no one in this game is actually fair, playing fair.
Those models don't get played anymore, like Iron Fang Python.
Oh god, I'm literally putting I literally got a bunch of Assault Commanders on my desk for use in a newbie tournament, right?
You should play more Iron Fang Pikemen.
For extra fucking terribleness.
Yeah, bring back Iron Rusk 1 with 30 Iron Fang Pikemen. Let's do this.
I think
bring back 2012.
Yeah, Assault Commandos are maybe too confusing for new players. You just play Iron Fang Pikemen. There's nothing confusing about them. There's a pike. They stab them.
There's very confusing things about them, like their price tag.
Their defensive stats.
And their Black Dragon Iron Fang Pikemen. There's a lot confusing going on there, man.
Yeah. All right. Should we do a podcast of 2 hours dedicated about Iron Fang Pikemen? That would be great.
No.
That is what the people want to hear.
Just 2 hours on the worst two units, most boring two units in every faction.
We should start a Patreon. You know what? We should start a Patreon, so at least that if we are going to do this, that we get paid to do it. So, why not?
It's like Wolves of Orboros.
No, they're very interesting, Colin. Colin.
They have a very irritating
Tom.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I will defend that unit to the death, because that brought my best...
Well, that won't take very long.
Yeah. Yeah, to be fair, they'd be all dead by the time I finished defending them, so.
All right, guys, I'm going to cut and run.
Yeah, I'm going to go to bed. Right.
And I think
good night, guys.
It's probably going to wrap up. Good night, everyone.
Night, guys.
See y'all.
Yeah.
See ya. And see you all, listeners. Good night.